Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palaccio, on this weekly journey through culinary history. If I say ancient Roman food, I think usually that would conjure up some visions of elaborate feasts, of exotic foods, maybe peacock tongues and pigs stuffed with geese, and endless parades of wine-filled amphora. And rightly so. Because much of what we commonly know about Roman food, if you're not a student of that, it mostly comes probably from some of the ancient writings, the satires of Juvenal or Petronius, the extravagant banquets of the wealthy Romans. Not necessarily true or accurate, but definitely reflecting some of the culture and dining of the times. Closer study of the food of that period has attracted both scholars and food enthusiasts and reveals recipes and daily habits that are quite interesting and might even be surprising to people who think that it was, you know, all so untouchable and unusual. My guest today is one of those enthusiasts, bringing her study of archaeology into the mix. She's Farrell Monaco, a member of EXARC, Experimental Architecture, we'll find out, and the SAA, Society for American Archaeology. Farrell has combined her love of history, cooking, and travel with her studies of archaeology to write an informative and entertaining website and blog called TavolaMediterranea.com, or Mediterranean Table, in which she recreates ancient dishes of Rome and the Roman era and the rest of the Mediterranean. But today we're focusing on the Roman era. Welcome, Farrell.
Hi.
I'm so glad you could join us. Farrell's out on the West Coast, so forgive our connection here if things get rocky. But Farrell, tell me, what came first, your love of archaeology and your study of archaeology or food?
I would say that they ran together, actually. I've always been interested in archaeology, and I've been studying it for quite a while. But I've always been very creative in the kitchen as well. So throughout my ongoing studies in archaeology, I've always been focused on archaeology of food, ceramics mainly, transport amphora. And in studying that and in looking at food ceramics in the Roman Mediterranean, I kept being drawn back to a point that was about the food itself. Like when you study ceramics in the Roman Mediterranean or Roman archaeology, food archaeology, it tends to veer off towards, you know, what broader meanings you can extract from it, like social or economic data. Mm-hmm. But I kept being drawn to the food itself, and I wanted to know more about what did that food taste like? What did it feel like? What was the texture of that bread? How punchy was that oil, for example? And so I found myself taking the archaeological data and then translating it into something that it was edible so that I could actually kind of insert myself into the process as that missing human in the interpretive process so that I could taste the food, literally, by using, you know, the writings, the archaeological data, and in some cases, the pictorial record as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you do a wonderful job in recreating many of those recipes. Is this what you call, is this the term edible archaeology? Is this what you mean by that term that you've coined?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's, I kept thinking that, you know, like for in archaeology in general, we tend to want to quantify everything. We want to count and weigh things and put it into Excel and turn it into a scatter plot or charts that we can look at. And, you know, we can count pot sherds, for example. We can count ceramic sherds. And we can see that there's X amount of Dressel 20, for example, like Betacan olive oil containers. And we can then say, all right, but we know that there's a significant presence of Betacan olive oil in the Roman market during this specific time period. But like I said earlier, I kept thinking more about the oil, and I wanted to know, what's the quality of the oil like? If it was so popular, what did it taste like? And so the kind of the sub-disciplines of experimental archaeology or sensory archaeology, for me, it felt like that part of the process was pretty integral. Like, I don't want to just count the pot sherds and then say, okay, there was a significant economic relationship between Hispania and Rome at that point. I wanted to actually focus on the food itself and that reflection of Roman daily life, not just the economic or the social aspect
mm-hmm.
of it.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, once again, you know, as an archaeologist, when you're looking at data, you're always missing that human component of the process. So if you insert yourself as a surrogate in that process and you decide, okay, I'm going to take the writing of Pliny, for example,
mm-hmm.
and I'm going to take this grain mill and I'm going to labor away at it and I'm going to use this mortar and I'm going to feel what it's like to actually spend 2 solid hours to make my lunch. And I'm going to slave over this, and I'm going to use these ingredients and understand how much that person valued that meal because it was hard work. That, to me, tells me a lot more about that person than quantifying potsherds, for example.
Mm.
It tells me a lot more when I put myself into the process, and then through, you know, kind of remaining cognizant throughout that process of all of my senses, how sore are my arms? How sore are my hands? My back is getting sore, for example. I recently got a manual grain mill, which were quite common in some of the smaller households in the Roman Mediterranean.
Mm-hmm.
And I used this thing for almost half an hour, and I made 2 cups of emmer wheat flour.
I was going to say that. I'd seen that.
I thought, I'm going to have to call my chiropractor because I thought, my God, this is a lot of work. But I valued that flour, and I valued the bread that I made with it.
Right.
And it made that meal so much more important to me, and it became quite apparent to me how integral food was in the daily life of Romans. This was your daily life, food procurement and preparation and consumption. It was central to daily life. Aspect of it.
Right.
And then tasting it, making that archaeology something that I can taste.
Mm-hmm.
Put me that much closer. It broadened the interpretive scope, the interpretive process for me.
Right. And then, of course, taste is that's the subjective and difficult place to go and try to figure out.
It is.
You know, we don't know how it tasted. We don't grow the wheat, the exact same wheat. I mean, there are people who are working at reviving and finding some of the ancient grains and the seeds to plant them. But it's going to taste differently.
And they have changed over time.
Yeah, exactly. And the water is different and everything's different. So you're getting an approximation. But I think that's interesting that it's the work that the actual process of making the food. It really, I can understand that one really does come to a different understanding of what it took to make that loaf of bread. But
you can literally walk a mile in the shoes of the original cookbook, the original cook. You can walk a mile in his or her shoes, and you can understand what that daily process was like, and it's quite beautiful.
Hmm. Interesting. When you say that you get the shards of the different pottery, the transport amphora. Now, these were found in market areas or the amphora were used in only in transport. I understood that that they would also be used in the home for storage.
I mean, they could. I mean, transferred amphorae literally are they're often dubbed the archaeological garbage of the Mediterranean because they're ubiquitous. They're
right,
everywhere.
Right.
They're you know lining the seabed of the Med. They are all over what used to be the Roman Empire. in Rome in particular, which is where I worked in 2016 when I volunteered with CPAC and Archeo Spain, Monte Testaccio, which is a part of the Emporium River Wharf complex in Rome, which was a part of the food supply chain. Monte Testaccio is a massive man-made landfill that is comprised mainly of Spanish Dressel 20 olive oil ceramic amphora.
Hmm.
And so this is one incredible source for not just food consumption, but economic relationships. And it, I mean, you can see some pretty incredible stuff happening when the Tunisians started to nose their way into the market in the mid-third century. And so this mound is, it's a way to date the olive oil market during the first three centuries of the empire. And it's a way to also look at consumption levels of olive oil in Rome. So transport amphorae, they're not just pieces of ceramic garbage. They are relative dating tools. They're tools to look at consumption. They are tools to look at business relationships, trade routes through the Mediterranean. They are, to me, they are one of the most valuable pieces of archaeological data for food that the Roman Mediterranean has to offer.
That is very interesting. I would love to take a little dive into that one. That would be fun. Something totally different for me. So that would be fun. What other than, now you mentioned olive oil a lot, and I, of course, you know, read about archaeologists digging up things, and of course, Pompeii, which we'll talk about shortly, you know, gave us such a wealth of knowledge for so much of the food. Carbon dating the remains of something that they find. Is this something that still, are you still finding, are organizations and digs still finding new recoveries of pottery that has some of this remains?
Well, I mean, that's pretty tricky. My understanding is that to resort to chemical analysis or carbon dating is usually quite expensive. So archaeologists will resort first to, looking at it visually,
mm-hmm.
and assessing what it is, you know, if they find, for example, carbonized seeds, like the museum in Bosco Reale, outside of Naples, has a fantastic array of burnt and carbonized foodstuffs that they found that were a result of the eruption in 79 AD. They will resort first to assessing it visually, then they'll resort to chemical analysis because it is quite expensive. Amphorae, for example, or foodstuffs that are in the holds of ships,
mm-hmm.
that have sunk, those can be quite telling, especially, for example, in Turkey in the Black Sea, there's the four shipwrecks, Sinop, A, B, C, and D. Those ships sunk and are presently in an anoxic environment. It's anaerobic. There is no oxygen. There's no decomposition. So they're in a perfect environment where I believe that there's actually foodstuff that's still preserved,
uh-huh.
but they can't exactly pull it out. They can't take it out. I believe they've chosen to leave them in situ. In the ships in order to be able to study them from a distance and where they currently rest. Chemical analysis is being done. In fact, I was reading in an Italian book about the flavors and the food of Pompeii that they did actually do chemical analysis on some of the bread that was found in the bakery of Modesto, that the infamous Panis Quadratus, the one with the eight cuts and the eight wedges.
Right. Oh, the black carbonized one.
Yes. On that. And again, the museum in Bosco Reale has some fantastic examples of you know, of dregs of the bottom of a garum amphora. And so I think visually you can assess it and conclude what it is first, but then if they want to do residue analysis of the inside of an amphora, they can, but I do know that it's expensive.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit. You mentioned a garum amphora, so we will describe for our listeners what this is, and I've read some interesting things, how they realized what it was that they found when they found it, but garum being the seasoning made from fish, from fermented fish.
Interesting stuff.
Yeah. But they, and they found, and I'm doing another show on that shortly, but and they found the remains of fish bones and fish that had been used and was, or had not yet been used even to make the fermentation. And that was their common seasoning, correct?
It was indeed. It was kind of like MSG for the Romans. Mm-hmm. It was a flavor enhancer, and it was a way to salt your dishes. And it's something that's very interesting to me, because if you think about the preparation process of it, it's quite hideous. It's, I mean, they would leave, you know, open doli or open vats, large ceramic containers of fermenting fish entrails and guts, the leftovers of the fish with, you know, that were heavily salted, and they would leave it out, you know, to ferment in the sun for God knows how long. And the smell that must have come off of it must have been phenomenal. But clearly, they did it with success, because they didn't, you know, kill the entire population off with food poisoning, right?
Right.
I mean, this is one dish that one dish that I won't touch.
Well, now you know
I am afraid that I will make myself sick in the process.
No, you might think about that again. I have a daughter-in-law who is heavy into fermentation and alchemy. I have a couple of barrels fermenting in my one
Do
of my barns
really?
Upstate. Yeah, and it's wonderful what
you
she
have
produces.
Barrels of garum in your house?
What? Not in the house. No, God no. But outside in a barn. But it takes many years. It takes a long time. But the product that it produces is just unbelievable. Really delicious.
I would be interested in speaking to her then.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, let's talk about some of the foods. Now, obviously, we don't learn about all the foods from the shards of pottery and the remains in a dig. But there are a lot of other sources that we use, and obviously you have used, in order to find some of these dishes that you like to cook and recreate.
Correct.
Tell us where do you go? Do you go to in particular?
Well, the written record, of course, is fantastic for sourcing ingredients and instruction.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, from Pliny to Cato to Columella to Apicius, they weren't big on measurement. They weren't. It's very rare that you'll be told how much of this and how much of that you need to put in. So there's some experimentation that's involved. I have used Columella's writing, Cato's writing, Dura Rustica, the Agricultura, Pliny's Historia Naturalis, the Apician recipes as well. And recently, actually, I had fun with this recipe. I made a Maratum recipe from a Virgil poem. And
okay, so do you have to describe? You have to describe to
absolutely
us.
Absolutely incredible.
Okay,
because it was so telling. I mean, this poem, it pleased me so much because it was quite extensive. It went through the entire morning of this Roman plowman named Simulus, and you know him getting up and deciding to make his breakfast and calling on his slave to help him. And it literally told you how to make this heavily garliced maratum that actually turned out to be quite tasty. And the poem to me was beautiful because it explained so much of the labor involved, and it also explained, it portrayed his thinking and kind of how hard his life was and how lonely he was and how he toiled over his mortarium making his maratum. And I got sucked into this so quickly, and I thought, this is fantastic. And I followed the poem, and I did his movements, and I ground my grain. That was what I got the grain mill for. And I felt literally like I was in Simulus's shoes. So that particular piece of the written record for me was incredible, and it produced something that I felt accurate, because the poem was very, very accurate in how much to put in. And the funny part about it was the amount of garlic that it asked for. And I followed it. I put in 4 bulbs of garlic, and I was terrified. But when I ate it, it was phenomenal. It was great, really hot.
Now, describe for our listeners what a maratum is.
Maritim is kind of strange. It's like a cheese salad. So it incorporates fresh or aged cheese with greens and herbs, sometimes garlic, sometimes not. And you start with your greens and your herbs and your mortar, and you pulverize it, and then you add in the cheese, and you mix it together. And from my findings, you can often have kind of a dip consistency, or you can also eat cheese ball consistency. And it goes really well with tracta or flatbread, or, you know, a nice hearty panis quadratus, like a nice whole wheat bread. But yeah, it's kind of a combination of cheese and greens and herbs mixed together. Yeah. Like a Roman cheese ball.
See, I think that's something that people would be surprised that would be a flavor an item that would be on the table.
It seemed to be quite popular. It's written about quite a fair bit.
Yeah, exactly. And when you were naming the different sources, what's wonderful is so many of the Roman era scholars have taken a closer look and a closer study of a lot of the books of ancient Rome, particularly Apicius, of course, Apicius, depending on how you want to say it.
Yeah.
Yes. Sally Granger and Christopher Grocock particularly come to mind. And of course, Andrew Darby and Sally Granger have also done a couple of nice books, a classical cookbook from the era. What's nice is, I don't know if you have used, I think you said you did use the recipes that they reproduced in Apicius. Hopefully she'll be here in the spring and we can get it from her directly. But they've made them very approachable, the recipes, don't you find?
Yeah. They have indeed, and they've done two versions as well. But the book, one of my Bibles, is their critical version,
right.
Grocock and Granger's critical version, because it doesn't clean it up.
Dumb it down.
For the average home cook.
Right.
It is exactly as it should be, so it allows you more flexibility to play with it. It shows you how ambiguous it is at times. And you are forced to experiment and to look into it and to see the original. They've published the Latin and then an English translation so that you can really dive deep on it.
Right. It's nice.
And I greatly appreciate that book.
One page facing another, which is terrific. I love that too. So tell me about another dish that you found particularly intriguing and perhaps delicious or not delicious.
Okay. One of the other dishes that I enjoyed making and that I actually got quite a fair bit of email on as well was Columella's cheese using fig rennet. And I remember starting that and I thought, okay, I'm going to do this by the book. And I have fig trees in my backyard. So I decided, okay, I'm going to do this. I'm going to, you know, cut down my figs and get as much sap, the white, bitter sap that comes out between the stalk and the fig head, and I'm going to see how much it's going to take, because Columella said that if you are not able to find animal rennet, which, again, in the modern era, I'm not keen on that, and I don't know how I would extract animal stomach acids myself, so I decided to go with his suggestion to use fig rennet. And I was so over the moon, because it worked like a charm. And so originally what I did was I cut a whole bunch of figs off, and I tried to catch the rennet as best that I could in my hand and in a bowl. You can't really get a lot out of it. You can get maybe a tablespoon if you cut, I would say, you know, 20 to 30 figs off. But what I did find that worked really well was taking the stalks from the fig head back a few inches, doing a slit in them, and then boiling that and extracting the rennet in the water. And so I just put, you know, maybe a couple tablespoons of the fig rennet water, the sap reduction that was in the water, into my whole milk, and it separated like a charm. And I was over the moon. I was so happy. And then, you know, when I put it together, separated the curds from the whey, I strained it in cheesecloth, and then I tasted it. And it was interesting, because it had a slightly bitter undertaste in the back of the throat from the fig sap, but it didn't bother me. And it was, and again, I looked at that and I thought, oh, that's something that they tolerated, and that's something that was probably quite common in their cheese making if they used this method.
But how much did that
cheese with a slightly bitter undertaste?
I was going to say how much of it actually came out in the cheese. You could taste it in the cheese.
It was an aftertaste. Yeah. It wasn't present at first, but you know, a couple of seconds after eating it, you got a tiny little shot in the back of the throat, and it was the fig sap.
Oh,
and I did do reading before I made it, just to make sure that I wasn't going to poison myself. And I had read that some people had allergic reactions to it, fig sap, when it touches the skin. So I put that warning out and said, you know, if you think that you're going to be sensitive to this, do not conduct this experiment. But I let everyone live vicariously through me as I consumed it and touched it with my hand.
Very interesting. Well, we're going to talk about a couple of other recipes and about your experience in Pompeii with a study as well when we come back after this short break. So stay tuned.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's unique store in Lower Manhattan is home to perhaps the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan, plus the rarest natural sharpening stones and exquisitely designed tableware. They also host special events such as knife sharpening demonstrations and parties with New York's most famous chefs and restaurateurs. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the implicit and elegance of Japanese culture to your table, be it in your home or in the finest restaurant. For more information, visit korin.com. Between your life and stories told about the deeds that made you.
Hi, we're back. And I am talking with Farrell Monaco. Farrell is an archaeologist and a food enthusiast and publishes a wonderful website and blog called TavolaMediterranea.com, where a lot of these recipes she's talking about you can find there, and you can read more about the process and perhaps find one that you too want to play around with. Farrell, you did a couple of really wonderful sweet recipes that I think the one in particular is the platina, which I think bears talking about, like a flan. Could you describe that for us, please?
I think you're referring to the tyropatinum.
Yes.
Or the tyropatina.
Oh, patina.
The Apician recipe.
Yes.
It's lovely. It's very simple, made with egg and cream. And what I loved about it was that it's very similar to custard, to what we eat nowadays. And it gave me a strong indication of the Roman sweet tooth and how they appreciated desserts as much as we do. And very easy to make, very simple, but very decadent as well.
Mm. And, I mean, could you not have... I read through the recipe, and 20 eggs, and I'm thinking, okay, how many people are we serving here? And you could not find a way to cut that down to make the final product, or you just decided to make a big batch?
You know what? I'm not looking at the recipe right now,
okay.
But I do know that I made a lot of them. There were a lot, and I had decided to make individual ones because I know my readers, rather than make, you know, a large one, the little mini tiny ones are much more easy to consume in the modern era. But I do remember having quite a few of them. Mm. Quite a few tins of them on the go.
Yeah, it seemed like quite a whisking job. Let me say that. But
it was.
But it's interesting because the foods. I mean, they're just so people realize, I think to let them know that before things change, and I'm saying things change in the modern era quite a bit, but the Romans pretty much ate three meals a day, not unlike, you know, our habits today. And
correct.
Right. And there, so they had, you know, they had their meats and their fish, and of course the wealthy would get them no matter where they were.
Exactly.
And the bread. And so I wanted to talk just a little bit. Well, let's jump to Pompeii, because I wanted to talk about ovens.
Sure.
Being that you, I'm sure, saw a lot of excavated pieces in your study. But you had a wonderful opportunity to work in Pompeii. Tell us about that.
I did, yeah. Last summer I worked with the Pompeii Food and Project, or the Pompeii Food and Drink Project, and they, it's a fantastic project that's been going for 17 years, and they have been studying all of the features and structures of Pompeii that are food and drink related, and they have been logging them meticulously in a database that is almost done. And it will be, I know it's for academic use. I believe it may be for public use in the future as well. And it's essentially preserving all of that data in a database, because the site itself is suffering quite a fair bit under, you know, the stress of the traffic that's in there daily. I mean, the tourist traffic is essential to the conservation efforts, mm-hmm. but it's also causing damage. So this project is logging all of the food and drink buildings, houses, the Caponia, the Thermopolia, and making sure that that data is there in the future for everybody to study the food consumption and preparation processes at Pompeii.
Mm-hmm. It is so much better than it was, I too have read about the dangers of all the traffic and the vehicular traffic, which is, you know, causing destruction. They did close parts of it and limit some of the hours, I know. But what's so wonderful is to walk in and actually see things you read about, or have maybe one has read about. The tavernas, which are there, they are to see.
Beautiful.
Yeah. I think of the pots, the amphora, the things that would go in these. If you have not seen a picture of a Roman taverna, it's kind of like what we would say, what would you say, like a hot table, like a prepared food stand.
It's a fast food counter.
Yeah, a fast food counter, good, yeah.
It's fantastic. It's a fast food counter with dolia that are in situ underneath it. They're permanently fixed into the counters. And, you know, they would have contained, I don't know, bean stew or different hot foods. They would have served drinks as well. And I liken, you know, the tavernas to almost like, it's like a plebeian fast food counter. Mm-hmm. You would go in there and you would hit it on the way home or on the way out, you know, during the daytime. Some people did not have cooking facilities. If they lived in insula, or if they lived in, you know, the apartments or the smaller dwellings, they wouldn't have cooking facilities, so they had to eat out. And some of these tavernas also had sidewalk benches, and you can see them throughout Pompeii as well, where people would sit and they would eat a meal and then they'd be on their way.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And, of course, there's still the Roman or the Italian prevalence of tavola calda and the hot tables, which is the same thing.
It all translates forward beautifully.
Yeah, that's great.
It does. And then the bakeries themselves are stunning as well. The bakeries I'm enamored with, mm-hmm. and I've been enamored with them for years. You walk into them, and you see the ovens, and you see those large hourglass grain mills, and something just catches you. It's so incredible to see that industry, to see how, you know, the high volume of bread that was being produced daily to feed Pompeii or to feed Rome, for example. Ostia also has some incredible bakeries and granaries at Portus, etc. The bread consumption and the grain consumption, you know, during the Republic and the Empire, it was massive. And these bakeries can attest to that beautifully.
Interesting. They, I mean, they would, in times of in dire needs, they had, I mean, to be on the dole, they would dole out portions of grain. I mean, grain was so important that they...
Correct.
They would, they'd have the great grain storages. The So the breads, the wonderful finds, the original wonderful finds, and then some of the later at Pompeii, like you talked about the Panis Quadratus, and the one that was black and charred, but you could still see the divisions. So you know so you could see the shape of the bread. So when you reproduce some of these, you know what you're making, right?
Yes and no. And Panis Quadratus is a thorn in my side. Because it's something that I've been studying and reading about and digging deeper on for a long time. I published a recipe, kind of a prototype, like a beginning recipe for it in, I think it was November of last year, and got a really good debate going with a lot of my readers and a lot of academics and whatnot about the form and the shape, the tool that was used to make those wedges on top. It is not a cut. We know it's not a cut. It's like a blunt instrument that's used to make it. But we're not sure if it's something that is coming from the center of the loaf, like Greta Stefani, the director at Pompeii. She had written that she felt that it was a blunt tool that was being pivoted from the center of the loaf outwards.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Some people feel that it's almost like a large apple cutter, right?
Yeah.
But the problem is that there's nothing in the archaeological record to tell us this. There's nothing. There's no metal cutter. There is nothing that has been found in the bakery of Modesto, which is where these 80 loaves of bread were found, the carbonized loaves, to tell us what made those cuts. And then further from that, why? Why the cuts?
Mm-hmm.
Is it strictly decorative? Is it for sectioning off pieces throughout the day? Does it tell us anything about the average size of a family? You know, if 8 cuts, is it symbolic in nature? So that loaf of bread to me is probably one of the most beautiful pieces of evidence of food archaeology for the Roman Empire, because it is trying to tell us a lot, but we don't know quite yet what it is. And that ridge around the outer edge of it, the outer rim.
Now, describe it for our listeners, and that's almost like a... So the bread bakes up, and almost the top of it's almost like a muffin top in a way, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what's tricky about that is, I mean, some people have proposed twine, and I tried twine in my last recipe because I thought, you know what, I'm going to give it a go. Maybe it was something that was baked in because it made it for easy carrying, or maybe they hung the loaves up to cool because they didn't have enough space if they were producing a high volume of bread daily. But the twine was very clumsy. It felt like it was a waste of my time, and you know, if I was a baker in, you know, like the bakery of Modesto or Papidius Priscus, I wouldn't have time to tie twine around all of these loaves of bread. So, was it a bowl? Was it a padella? Was it a pan? But the problem is if you flip that loaf out once it's risen and you flip it out, how is the bottom still beveled and rounded if it's inside of a pan, unless it's oven spring that's making it push itself out, you know, and making it balloon on the bottom as well as on the top.
Hmm.
So Panis Quadratus is very tricky, and it's something that I'm continuing to look into, and I'm going to follow it up with yet another attempt to see what could have made those cuts. And it's something that I'm going to dig even deeper on because I've had such a significant amount of email comments, messages on Facebook, and people saying, I think it's this, I think it's that. And so I'm going to kind of have a look at it under a microscope and try to figure out what made those cuts, what made the rim around the outer edge, and then why? Why?
Mm-hmm.
Is it strictly decorative?
That's what I was thinking. Was it strictly decorative? Who knows? You know, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there's one loaf of bread that was found that was cut in half. It was ripped in half. So they may have been doling it out in portions as well.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, something else that I thought about, and this, you know, when I saw the picture and I read some of the discussion, I was thinking, I liked your idea of the string. That seemed to be a good way to make that ridge. And was it so that it would help it rise a little more? But then I was thinking, you know, the bread, at least a long horizontal slice of the bread, would have been used in probably in a little bit, maybe in more in the modern era, but I think in the ancient era too, if I'm remembering correctly, as a trencher, as a plate to put the food.
Absolutely, as
on.
A utensil.
Yeah, now
utensil.
could this have been a marker for you'll eat the top of the bread where it's scored, and you'll slice off the bottom half below the, it's like above the salt, below the salt, above the ridge or below the ridge, you slice off below the ridge, and that becomes the trencher on the table. I don't know.
It's a wonderful theory.
Popped into this head as I was reading the wonderful discussion on it. And there are so many more wonderful discussions and so many sources, so much reading material. And we've only touched on a little bit, and I knew we would run out of time and not be able to touch on everything I had in mind and on my list. But before we do run out of time, I really want to talk about something that you and one of our good friends, Ken Albala, are doing this summer. Ken is a frequent guest here on Heritage Radio, and particularly on my show. And he's written the wonderful so many wonderful books, but then also particular to this show, the Guide to Food History Reading. I forget the actual title. Ken, kill me.
The Reader.
Okay, The Reader. Okay, The History Reader.
Another
right.
one of my Bibles.
Right. He gives you sources to go to when you are trying to, you know, to learn something and study about the food of different periods. But tell us about what you and Ken are doing this summer.
So, Ken and I are holding a food workshop at a 2,000-year-old Roman villa to the north of Rome that is located off of the Via Salaria. And so I had originally had this idea, and I thought, you know, given the response over last year and the readers who are writing in and emailing and the amount of engagement, I thought, wouldn't it be great if we could actually get a whole bunch of people together in an original setting with some of the original tools and the original foodstuffs to make this together, to engage in discussion, to eat it all together, and to explore that history further. And so Dr. Albala, he's always been very, very good to me, and I met him, quote-unquote, on Facebook about a year ago when I had been reading his stuff, and I friended him, and I saw that he was friending a lot of his readers and everything. And he's been very good to me throughout my experiments as well. Like, I'll message him on Facebook at 9 o'clock at night and say, this garum is terrible. How much should I be using? He's like, don't use too much. And he's like, by the way, I like it. And I'm saying, I think it's disgusting, you know. And he's always very approachable and available. When you've got questions about your ingredients or the process in general. So I had this idea, and I thought I would really, really love to be able to get a workshop up. And I approached Ken, and I said, would you be interested in doing this with me and working with me on this? And he said, absolutely. So I was over the moon, very happy about that. And so I went about finding what I felt to be the appropriate location because I thought there's no point in doing this in an apartment in Rome, for example, when you can do it in a villa where there's a triclinium in the backyard. There's remnants of a triclinium. There's archaeology there. It's a Roman villa that, of course, has been, you know, renovated and modernized. But it's as close to the original scenario as you can get, and I'm very excited about it. And it's being held from June 16th to the 23rd, and we are almost sold out, which makes me happy. And I'm very much looking forward to it.
But there are a couple spots left, right? So
there are.
If someone's very interested, you go to tavolamediterranea.com, and all the information will be there for you to check, as well as the wonderful writings that Farrell has published and the recreations of the recipes for you to try with recipes, so you can try them as well. And I think Ken is listening to us now. I think I just saw he posted here, so he can chime in there on when we post this later. There'll be a link posted later, and Ken will be joining me next week when we talk about something. We'll get to the Roman era. We're talking about the history of noodles. So Farrell, this is so exciting. I wish I could be there. I wish I could be a fly on the wall and be there and
we would love to
taste all
you.
The food. Yeah, but it's wonderful to know about, and hopefully it's something that can continue another time as well. And I encourage people to grab their books and get on the website and take a look. And Farrell, thank you so much. I look forward to reading more of your terrific posts.
You are so welcome. Thank you.
And thank you for listening to this version of A Taste of the Past.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.